This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Powered by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. The COVID-19 pandemic has taken an enormous toll on developing economies. But complicating the pace of recovery for our region is the ongoing geopolitical tensions between the US and China. How can developing countries better use industrial policy? In other words, the strategic effort by the state to encourage economic transformation to build back in the post-COVID era. Joining me today on the show to discuss some of these themes is Dr. Robert Wade, Professor of Political Economy and Development at the London School of Economics. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill, Professor Wade.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, before we delve into present-day scenarios, I would like to revisit your earlier work on development and industrial policy. From what I understand, you've long been skeptical of free markets being the sole explanation or prescription for economic advancement, and you cited the intervention of government as a key influence in the growth of East Asian markets in the 1970s and 80s. Why aren't free market policies an automatic recipe for prosperity?
Not surprisingly, the answer is complicated, but the kind of consensus in the West, and this is particularly in the U.S., in the U.S. government, in American economics, has been that governments should basically stay out of the economy. They can do some regulation. They can adopt what are sometimes called horizontal measures that apply to all businesses, but government should not try to shape the production structure. The production structure of any country should simply be the result of free market competition. The implication of this approach, this free market approach, is that it doesn't matter whether free market competition leads the economy to specialize in making potato chips or making computer chips. As long as potato chips are more profitable, then the economy should concentrate on potato chips. Now, of course, I'm exaggerating just to make the point. But the result of all this, this emphasis on free markets producing the best results, is that the whole of the set of countries that we call developing countries, that is, the countries not in the North, and by the North, I mean Western Europe, North America, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the whole of the rest of the world over the past half century remains far behind in terms of average income to the North. That is to say, regions of the South and specific countries of the South, in terms of the percentage of their average income relative to that of the North, it remains flat. It has not risen. They've not been catching up, with very few exceptions, the Northeast Asian ones being the obvious exceptions. And so this basic approach to economic development of saying, let the market work, or Ronald Reagan's government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem. All this whole approach has resulted in the continuation of a very bifurcated or bipolar world economy, with countries of the North remaining very prosperous and countries of the South remaining on average income levels, which are 20% or maybe 25% even, or many in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, more like 15% of the average income of the North. So this is a real tragedy for 80% of the world's population.
Okay, so you posit that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that free market policies haven't worked in the vast majority of the global South to improve economic outcomes.
Having said that, I have to add just one other point. I've said that there has been very little convergence upwards or catch up in terms of income, average income. But on the other hand, there's been quite a lot of catch up or convergence in measures other than income. For example, life expectancy. Life expectancy in southern countries has been converging upwards to life expectancy in the north. Infant mortality has been going down in the south, just towards levels of infant mortality in the north. Education measures in the south have been improving, have been catching up. Literacy, numeracy have been catching up relative to the north. So on the one hand, there's very little catch up in terms of income in the south, but there's a lot of catch up relative to non-income measures. And it's a puzzle as to why the catch up in non-income measures, like including literacy and so on, and health, has not translated through to catch up in terms of income. And I think part of the reason is because of this emphasis coming from the north on the need for southern countries, southern regions, to practice free market policies and not do anything by way of trying to promote the shift in national production structures towards sectors that are better for economic development than other ones.
What makes government intervention effective, though? Because just as there are examples galore of free market policies failing the global south, there's also just as much evidence showing the harms of government overreach or state capture for the economy.
Governments can make an exercise in foresight, looking ahead with reference to the whole national economy and with reference to the world economy, and to see where new market opportunities are opening up. And the point is, it's in general terms, it's not in the interests of private firms to undertake exercises in foresight across the whole economy. They may undertake exercises in foresight across their particular sector, but not across the whole economy. So government is in a position to make these broad judgments across all sectors of the economy as to where the growth potential lies. They have information, they can have information, which allows them to identify future leading sectors into which they might be able to encourage domestic investment. So that is the potential, one also has to recognize that in many cases of where governments have tried to do this in the past, their efforts, for example, to give subsidies to particular sectors, have been corrupted. That is, the subsidies have been captured by firms, which then do not use the subsidies in the way that was intended. They use the subsidies for paying the executives super bonuses, for example, or putting the money in Swiss bank accounts. So the point I'm making is that you can see, standing back, that something like industrial policy to steer the production structure is a necessary condition for economic catch-up of countries of the South. It's a necessary condition, but it's certainly not a sufficient condition, because there are so many cases where it hasn't worked. But having said that, you also have to recognize that it's not just the government that can fail. The private sector can fail, and the evidence is from venture capital firms. Venture capital firms make investments in new firms and new technologies, and they expect to get a large return. But they also expect that many of their investments will fail, but they expect that their large returns from the ones that work will compensate for the ones that fail. I'm making this point because it is commonly said by free market economists that governments cannot pick winners. But the private sector also fails. Venture capital firms do not always pick winners. The whole venture capital model is based on the idea that only some investments will be successful, but it's still worthwhile to make investments across a whole range, some of which will fail. And the government basically has to be thinking in the same kind of terms and not be put off by those who say, oh, governments cannot pick winners.
I'm speaking to Professor Robert Wade of the London School of Economics on the role of industrial policy in economic development. When we come back, how should developing economies factor in geopolitical tensions in their growth strategy? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and on the show with me today is Dr. Robert Wade, Professor of Political Economy and Development at the London School of Economics. Professor Wade, let's turn over to some of the trends we're witnessing in the post-COVID-19 era. In the years post-pandemic, there's been a lot of talk about deglobalization and decoupling. How do you see this playing out?
Remember, we are not just in a post-COVID era. We are in an era of intense US-China competition and hostility, in fact. I mean, what has happened is that geopolitics now is shaping economic policy. If you remember, the old Washington consensus was all about economics. Now there's a new Washington consensus, but it's about geopolitics shaping economics, that is economic policy, trade policy, foreign investment policy, export controls, and so on. All these are being shaped by geopolitics in this new Washington consensus. So this makes it very difficult for developing countries. There's talk in Washington of deglobalization, but actually now, especially since the G7 summit in Hiroshima, so it's now called de-risking, which seems much more conventional, but it does mean giving much more attention to ensuring that supplies of critical goods cannot be used as weapons against oneself. So in particular, the US is trying to ensure that China cannot use its control of vital goods to put pressure on the United States, that is to weaponize its control of vital goods, even as the US is itself using its control of vital goods to put pressure on China. The US is weaponizing its control of semiconductors, for example, to try and limit China's technological rise.
So what does this then mean for supply chains and trade movements, which for the past several decades have been all about free trade and prioritizing economic costs?
I think that there's a kind of convergence now in the G7 around the idea of, quote, friend shoring, that is not bringing U.S. firms now in China back necessarily back to the United States, but getting them to, at the margin, so to speak, to move out of China and maybe to, who knows, India or Vietnam or maybe Mexico. That the point being that these are seen as allies of the United States that will not weaponize their control of vital economic goods. And so friendshoring allows a kind of compromise to be made, or this is the thinking, a compromise between the benefits of globalization, global integration, you know, getting things produced in the place where they can be produced cheapest. Often that has been China. But now China is considered a source of danger. So friendshoring is a way of getting some of the benefits of global integration, like producing in Vietnam or other places where the costs may be higher than in China, but Vietnam is not going to weaponize, is not going to assert influence over the United States in the way that China might. I'm talking now of the US perception. I'm not saying that this is true.
So it seems that you're pointing to a development where the world economy is going to become incredibly fragmented. I mean, if there are different geopolitical centers of power and they're all choosing their friends, then economic development is going to progress along separate tracks, as we've seen so far between the global north and south, no?
Yes, but not incredibly fragmented, which was your phrase, basically fragmented into two blocks, two main centers of influence, the US and its allies, and China and its allies, including allies through this great investment program, the Belt Road Initiative. And China now has a great deal of influence in many countries of the South, thanks to this Belt Road Initiative, which has been going on now since, 2013 or so. And so, yes, there will be intense competition from both of these centers to get allies, get countries that are kind of lined up to support them. And that presents both opportunities, but also dangers for any country such as Malaysia, for example.
Do you think there'll come a point where countries in Malaysia's position of having to balance between these two competing powers, will they ultimately be forced to choose one side or the other?
There will, I think there will be pressures of that kind. But for example, if you think of the case of Australia, Australia depends very heavily on exports to China, but conversely, China depends very heavily on imports from Australia. But on the other hand, Australia is very, very keen to ally itself, especially militarily, with the Western Bloc. And we've been seeing now how the US is establishing military bases in Northern Australia. This AUKUS military alliance to provide Australia with nuclear submarines is another indication of this close alignment between Australia and the US and the West more generally. But at the same time, Australia is very, very keen to maintain these exports to China, and China needs to maintain their imports from Australia. So it's a very complicated game, and it requires a high degree of professionalism in governments like the Malaysian government to navigate through these tensions.
I'd like to end the conversation with your recommendations, Professor Wade, for a country like Malaysia, which is presently stuck in the middle income trap, despite projections or aspirations of becoming a high income nation status in the next decade. What would be your prescription to break out of the current low wage, low growth cycle?
Well, first of all, I hesitate to say anything about a country that I really know little about. I might just add in parenthesis that my father was New Zealand High Commissioner in Malaysia in the mid-1960s, and I visited at that time, but that's a very long time ago, I have not been following Malaysia with any attention ever since then. So I'm always hesitant to say what I think the government of a particular country should and should not do if I don't know that country reasonably well myself. So with that qualification, I would be looking to see to what extent there is a capacity in the Malaysian government to organize a science and technology program. So a big push on science and technology is one. Secondly, a push in the big industry, the growth industries of the future, a small number of growth industries in the future. But thirdly, and often neglected, and this was something that the government of Taiwan gave a great deal of attention to, that is a program to nudge small and medium enterprises into upgrading their production systems and into exploring new export markets. Let me just give an example of how Taiwan did this. So within the big Ministry of Economic Affairs in Taiwan, and I'm talking now about the 1970s and 80s and 90s, there was what was called the Industrial Development Bureau. So this was quite a small bureau, like 150 people, mainly engineers. And they were divided into sector teams. So these people were responsible for spending at least half of each working month, traveling Taiwan up and down the country, visiting small and medium enterprises, looking at the systems for, let's say, disposing of waste. To what extent could the system of disposing of waste in this particular factory be improved? Or to what extent could this factory do better by replacing that machine tool with an upgraded machine tool? And secondly, the engineers learnt about problems in these small and medium enterprises and brought their knowledge of the problems back into the center where the larger industrial policy of the country was being formulated, so that the formulation of the larger policy could be based upon quite detailed knowledge of problems being encountered at small and medium enterprises. So the basic point I want to make is that most of the talk about industrial policy concentrates on the government helping to promote the leading sectors of the future. But the second important thing, and which is generally neglected, and that's why I'm really emphasizing it now, is to have an organization in place which is targeted at small and medium enterprises. It's about giving small and medium enterprises an ongoing, a constant source of nudging of them to increase their productivity and to find new markets. And the point I particularly want to emphasize is that this nudging was going on in Taiwan all the time, every month, every year, every decade, from the 1950s onwards. And it seems to me very likely that this was an important reason for this very impressive upgrading across the board of Taiwan industries, so that even small and medium enterprises were able to participate in, for example, exports to the United States. So that seems to me a really important matter for any government to bear in mind.
Professor Wade, thank you very much for sharing your insights with me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Robert Wade, Professor of Political Economy and Development at the London School of Economics. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, 5G now with you.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.